Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ sanghaṃ namassāmi. This is quite a short sutta and quite straightforward, but it has some very interesting points which are relevant for both monastic and lay practitioners. So we'll just begin by reading through. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's sanctuary. Then when it was morning, the Venerable Bhumija, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went to the house of Prince Jayasena and sat down on a seat made ready. Prince Jayasena was one of the sons of King Bimbisara of Rajagaha, who was one of the Buddha's most devoted disciples. Then Prince Jayasena went to the Venerable Bhumija and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Venerable Bhumija, "Master Bhumija, there are some recluses and Brahmins who make such assertions and hold such views as this. If one makes an aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is unable to procure any fruit. If one makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. If one both makes an aspiration and makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. If one neither makes an aspiration nor makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. What does the Venerable Bhumija's teacher say here? What does he declare?" So we have a conversation between a bhikkhu and a lay person asking the question about aspirations. And an aspiration is something that we hear about very often. It's another form of a wish or a want, something that we wish to achieve. And in terms of the spiritual life, the aspiration to become a monk or a nun, the aspiration to become a stream winner or a once returner or a non-returner, or to become enlightened. These are the kinds of aspirations that we think about in reference to the spiritual life. But we also have other aspirations in our life, maybe in the spiritual sphere, not quite so lofty. So our aspiration might be, I want to become more peaceful and calm. I want to be able to control my anger. I want to be able to get on better with the people in my family. Or I want to be able to face decision making better. And so my aspiration, my reason, my desire for taking up meditation might be one of these things. We may not even articulate it in this way, but we have a purpose in doing what we're doing. We have a goal that we're setting ourselves, and we often are encouraged to determine our goal, especially if we're taking up the spiritual life, to determine that whatever good karma we do will support us in our aspiration to attain nibbana. rather than using our good karma for worldly happiness, worldly success, that we are deliberately, mentally put it into our Nibbana account rather than into our worldly account. So this is something which we do sometimes consciously or unconsciously, making an aspiration that this will lead us further on our path. In terms of Bhikkhu Bodhi's explanation, so if one makes a wish, if one raises a hope or expectation, so in making an aspiration, one raises a hope and one also raises an expectation that somehow having the aspiration will contribute to the realization of the goal. That the making the aspiration and articulating it is somehow going to bring about the desired result. And so Prince Jayasena is saying that he's heard from various teachers that if one lives the holy life and one makes an aspiration, one is unable to procure any fruit. So even if one makes an aspiration, that is not going to lead to the attainment of any stage on the path or of enlightenment. And if one makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. So even if you don't make an aspiration, you're still not going to realize the fruit. So if you make an aspiration or you don't. And if one both makes an aspiration and makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. So that is doing both. If one neither makes an aspiration nor makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life, one is still unable to procure any fruit. So talking here just about the action of making an aspiration or not making an aspiration. Not really specifying the quality of the aspiration. And then he asks Venerable Bhumaja, what does the Buddha have to say about that? How does he declare? And Venerable Bhumaja replies, I have not heard and learned that from the Blessed One's own lips, Prince, but it is possible that the Blessed One might say this. If one makes an aspiration and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is unable to procure any fruit. If one makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is still unable to procure any fruit. If one both makes an aspiration and makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is still unable to procure any fruit. If one neither makes an aspiration nor makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life unwisely, one is still unable to procure any fruit. However, if one makes an aspiration and one leads the holy life wisely, one is able to procure fruit. If one makes no aspiration and one leads the holy life wisely, one is still able to procure fruit. If one both makes an aspiration and makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life wisely, one is still able to procure fruit. If one neither makes an aspiration nor makes no aspiration, and one leads the holy life wisely, one is still able to procure fruit. I've not heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips, Prince, but it is possible that the Blessed One would answer as I have stated. So the answer that Venerable Bhumijar gives is that it's not dependent on the aspiration. The realization of the fruits depends on whether or not one leads the holy life wisely or unwisely. And this is actually quite an important point, because we all know about having hopes and wishes, what we'd like to achieve, what we'd like to happen, what we'd like to get in the future, whether we're talking about in a worldly sense or in terms of our spiritual growth and development. And Venerable Bhumijar, not sure whether he's accurately representing the Buddha, says that it's not so much about the aspiration, it's about how you live the holy life. And this is the point that is the crux of this teaching. Because we very often have our ideas about how we would like things to be, and we either don't put in the right conditions or ingredients, or we don't know what the right conditions and ingredients are for the realization of that fruit. And in the Buddha's teaching, if we want the result, we have to put in the right ingredients. But this is something which we can still fail to understand. We have an idea that we would like this, we want that. We can even have a 5-year plan, but if we don't actually do the work, we won't get the result. This is basic law of cause and effect. So we'll go on to hear whether or not Venerable Bhumijar has accurately represented the Buddha's teachings. So after having given a reply to the prince and saying that he's not sure whether he's representing the Blessed One correctly, the prince replies, "If Master Bhumijar's teacher speaks thus, if he declares thus, then it certainly seems that the Venerable Bhumijar's teacher stands ahead of all ordinary recluses and Brahmins." Then Prince Jayasena served the Venerable Bhumijar from his own dish of milk rice. And then when the Venerable Bhumijar had returned from his alms round after his meal, he went to the Blessed One. So, to contrast what the Venerable has said with what the other recluses are reported to have said, they were denying any connection between what one does as a cause and the effect, because they were saying basically that making aspirations will not produce fruits, that there won't be a result. Whereas when we consider, as we go through this sutta, we'll see that making an aspiration and having a sense of the goal that we are heading towards is one of the conditions. But in itself, it isn't a sufficient condition. And that's where the Buddha makes it clear to the Venerable when he comes to speak to him directly. So Venerable Bhumijar returned from his alms round after his meal, and he went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what had occurred, adding, "Venerable Sir, I hope that when I was asked such a question and answered thus, I said what has been said by the Blessed One and did not misrepresent him with what is contrary to fact. I hope I explained in accordance with the Dharma in such a way that nothing which provides a ground for censure can be legitimately deduced from my assertion. So Venerable Bhumaja was concerned that he may have misrepresented the Dharma, or that the way that he explained and answered the question would lead the questioner on to further doubts or thoughts that weren't in accordance with Dharma. And so he's checking it out with the Buddha himself. "Surely, Bhumaja, when you were asked such a question," this is the Buddha replying, "and answered thus, you said what has been said by me and did not misrepresent me with what is contrary to fact. You explained in accordance with the Dharma in such a way that nothing which provides a ground for censure can be legitimately deduced from your assertion. Whatever recluses and Brahmins have wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration, if they make an aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are unable to procure any fruit. If they make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still unable to procure any fruit. If they both make an aspiration and make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still unable to procure any fruit. And if they neither make an aspiration nor make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are still unable to procure any fruit. Why is that? Because that wrong path is not a proper method for procuring fruit." The Buddha goes on to give some very apt similes for what this wrong path is like. But it's very useful for us to consider, what is this wrong eightfold path? What is wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration? Because again, as we see the explanation of the Buddha for how to make a success of the spiritual life. Yes, sorry, I should have said yes. Please stop and stop me and ask a question. Well, they neither make an aspiration, they don't make any aspiration, or they might say, I'm not making any aspiration for the holy life. So they neither make any kind of aspiration, or they make, no, I'm not making any aspiration for the holy life. I have no aspiration for the holy life. Whatever happens, happens. Well, one is not even thinking about an aspiration, neither make an aspiration, or make no aspiration. I have no aspiration for the holy life. Yes, so one is a sort of consciously not having any ideas of what it's going to be like or what will come of it. The other is not even going that far, just doing it. Sorry, I should have said, if anyone has any questions, please stop me and... So he, sorry, was that a question? Good. So remembering that Venerable Bhumaja has answered that whether one makes an aspiration or not, that is not the thing that leads to the result. It's whether or not one leads the holy life wisely or unwisely. And so the Buddha is saying that there are recluses and Brahmins who lead the holy life unwisely because they have wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. So the first wrong view, there is a particularly central view which the Buddha said was the worst kind of wrong view, and that is to have the view that there is no consequences for our actions, that there is no natural law of cause and effect. And so there were recluses and Brahmins at the time of the Buddha who asserted that everything was predetermined and it didn't matter what you did, you couldn't change that course. It was an unalterable course. And this is somewhat implicit today in the caste system, the idea that one is born into a particular caste and one's dharma is to live out that caste position for the rest of one's life. And within this life, you can't change that. You can't change that positioning in society and the duties and responsibilities that go along with it. So that was one of the worst wrong views. Everything is predetermined and it doesn't matter what you do. Another kind of wrong view was that it doesn't matter what you do because there are no consequences for anything. That whether you do good or not, it doesn't make any difference. Everything can happen accidentally. There is no follow through with causes and the resultants. So both of those wrong views, the Buddha said, were the most blamable, because both of them take away the sense of responsibility for one's actions, that one is going to receive consequences for what one does, and that it's possible to change one's behaviour, to improve one's behaviour. It's possible to create good karma and improve the quality of one's life through one's own intentional thought, speech and action. And so that particular wrong view, those two kinds of wrong views, the Buddha said were the worst kind of wrong view that you could have. And there were at that time many recluses who lived according to that wrong view. The other kinds of wrong views were, for example, that one would be reborn in the heavenly realms if one practiced in a certain way, if one worshipped the gods, for example, if one, as many of the recluses were fire worshippers, and they performed all the right rituals and sacrifices, that they would be reborn in heaven. Or that if they bathed at the right time, at the auspicious time, and kept it up as a an ascetic practice, that they would be cleansed of their defilements. The Buddha said these views were not as bad as the first two that I mentioned, because they do recognize a cause and effect sequence. They do have a sense that you can do something, you can make an impact on your life. Even if it's wrongly founded, there is still a sense of it's important what you do, and there are things which are beneficial. So the Buddha said these wrong views were preferable to the idea that there's no consequence for any actions that we do. As well as these aspects of wrong view, which are central to the understanding of karma and karma vipaka, the actions and the results of actions, the other wrong views that existed would be around not understanding the Four Noble Truths, not seeing the unsatisfactoriness of existence and the cause of that unsatisfactoriness as self-centered craving. So there might be a sense of there's an unsatisfactoriness in life, but it's because of something outside oneself. It's because of God, or it's because of you're born into the wrong situation, and so that's the cause of your suffering. And if you can get out of that situation, say poverty, for example, then all your problems will be solved. So there's no deeper understanding, deeper penetration of the cause, the real basic cause of unsatisfactoriness in this life. So these would be the kind of wrong views which would take recluses and Brahmins onto a path which doesn't lead them to the goal of release. Wrong intention, again, if we think in terms of what is right intention, the intention to renounce, to renunciation, to giving up, to letting go, and not only renouncing one's material possessions, but also renouncing in terms of one's unskillful behaviours, changing one's way of looking at things, one's way of doing things, the intention to renounce and to let go is very central to this path of practice. So remembering that the Buddha was talking about what is a successful holy life, but if we're thinking about what is a successful spiritual life, even as a lay person, wrong intention can be in terms of what's called spiritual materialism. And this is the idea that through our spiritual practices, we'll become a better person, we'll become someone who's more clever, quicker on the uptake, able to be more skillful in our behaviours, stronger and able to cope with life better, and therefore will be more successful. And these are aspects of spiritual practice as we purify the mind of defilements, and as we practice and strengthen the mind and develop mindfulness and are much more present with our life, we do experience that our mind becomes clearer and we're more capable of dealing with difficulties, coping with frustrations, handling stress, all of those things. But that's only an aspect of the practice. The further we go in the practice, we realise that we are constantly needing to let go of our assumptions about ourself and about what happiness really is. The idea that once I get on top of my bad habits, then I'll be able to enjoy life to the full, that sort of thing. And the spiritual path is much more than this. It comes to a point where one is not only getting on top of one's bad habits, but the idea of where those bad habits come from, what role they've played, what sort of sense of self I've built around my habits, my attitudes, all of those things also need to be let go of. So the intention to renunciation is a very strong intention, not just in terms of materiality, but in terms of our whole approach to life. And the intention to non-harming, the intention to non-cruelty, the intention to loving kindness, these are also aspects of right intention on the Noble Eightfold Path. So if anyone takes up the spiritual life with a wrong intention, one can assume that it's with the intention of harming, of winning, of overcoming someone, of becoming more powerful, able to control other people. And so if you think about some spiritual teachers who develop a very powerful mind and then take advantage of their followers, their disciples, whether for monetary gain or to have power over their behaviour, for sexual satisfaction, all of those sorts of things. If the intention is a wrong intention, it's an intention which is based on self-centeredness and which leads to harm for the people that one is practicing with and leading, and also for oneself, if we think about the law of karma. And these are not unusual. It's not unusual to find people leading a spiritual life and fulfilling the role of a spiritual teacher who actually engage in this wrong behaviour. And so it's possible to bring to mind people who have engaged in wrong view and wrong intention. And then wrong speech. Speech which is dishonest, lying. Speech which is coercive. Speech which is haranguing. Again, if you imagine someone who's engaging in this spiritual path and developing a strong mind and then using that in order to coerce his disciples or her disciples into doing what they want, rousing anger and hatred amongst people through giving them that kind of talking along those lines, stirring them up, planting that kind of attitude in their mind. So the idea of our group is the only group that is right, and anyone else is practicing in the wrong way, and anyone else who isn't like our group is a threat to us. Yes, Bronwyn. So the person who's receiving anger, should they apologise? So angry speech, should they apologise? Why? What would they be apologising? Because they think they've caused the angry speech? Yes. Well, it can be appropriate. It depends on the circumstances. But if one's able to be mindful that and be on the receiving end, it may be skillful just to not say anything. That maybe apologising might incite the person more. So you need to see in the particular situation what might be appropriate. So wrong speech in terms of a spiritual path, you can see. If we look around the world today, there are many spiritual leaders who use their position, their spiritual authority, to set up this sense of us against them, and we're the only ones that know what's the right thing, and anyone who doesn't agree with us is a threat, and we should do something about them to protect ourselves. This kind of use of one's speech, particularly in the spiritual sphere, where one does start to gain influence over others and with disciples start to control their attitudes and their behaviours. So this is wrong speech, particularly in this way. But any speech which is deceptive, which is harsh, which is haranguing others, this is wrong speech. And wrong action, in terms of just the five precepts, this is important for lay people to consider, as well as those who are aspiring to spiritual growth in the holy life or as a lay person. Wrong action is action which causes harm, especially killing living beings, but harming living beings. Taking what isn't given, taking what belongs to others, and engaging in sexual misconduct. And all of those actions are actions which can be committed by so-called Brahmins and recluses under the guise of part of their spiritual path. So the killing of animals for sacrifice, for example, and that being regarded as a holy rite, something which is done for the benefit of people, to save them from a harm that might come, or to please the gods so the gods will look favourably. This is an example of wrong action that can be done in the name of spirituality. And taking what is not given is, again, one of the things which flows from spiritual teachers having disciples who trust them, and they very often use that trust to either take the disciples' belongings, not take them in a sense of just forcibly, but convince the disciple to hand over their goods to the teacher, or to surrender themselves and allow the teacher to direct them. So taking what is not given in this sense is really taking over the control of someone else's life, as though you know what's best for them and that they need to depend on you to know what to do. These are examples of wrong action in this kind of situation. And, of course, this brings us into the third precept, which is something which is in the past. I don't think it's quite so much the case now, because people are more familiar with, certainly in Buddhist circles, the idea of teachers taking advantage sexually of their disciples was something which was quite rampant in some Buddhist groups in the past. But I think that most spiritual seekers in the West these days are much more sophisticated and know much more about the limitations of behaviour between teachers and disciples. But we also know that there are many cases where students and those under the care of those living a spiritual life have been sexually abused in the name of it being something that is their duty, their obligation, or something that is good for them, helpful on their life, in their life. And so wrong action is not something which is foreign to those who are spiritual seekers or those living a spiritual life. And then wrong livelihood. And the Buddha mentions a number of wrong livelihoods for lay people, but he also mentions wrong livelihoods for those in pursuing the spiritual path. So for lay people, selling poisons, dealing in weapons, dealing in alcohol and drugs, these are all considered to be wrong livelihood that should not be engaged in. Dealing in animal flesh and dealing in human beings, human trafficking, slavery, these are also considered to be wrong livelihoods. And that's for lay people. But basically, we're looking at any behaviour, any livelihood that exploits others and causes them harm. Yes. These are the areas where one can make one's decisions basically on one's own sensitivity. The Buddha doesn't just say slaughtering animals, he mentions animal flesh. So in that sense, something like breeding animals for slaughter and also selling the flesh of animals that have been slaughtered. But one may limit it only to the actual slaughtering if that's the interpretation that you give to it. I haven't got the actual reference, but it's mentioned a number of times. You'd have to look it up, probably. Oh yes, in the suttas. No, in the suttas. Yes. You'll be able to look it up and find. I haven't annotated all this sutta and looked up all the references, but definitely you can find that. Actually, I think if you look in the Anguttara Nikaya under the fives, you'll find it. So for those in the spiritual life, the Buddha mentions a number of things which are inappropriate for those practicing this as a livelihood. And he mentions the low arts, which are astrology and reading palms, reading the sounds of animals, reading predicting people's future, depending on the shape of their head, all of the things which are skills which can be practiced. It's not that they're not to be practiced at all, but they're not right livelihood for monastics or for anyone who's taking up the holy life. And even the practicing of medicine and the skills of medicine for a recluse should only be within the monastic community, not as a doctor to the lay community. So in terms of wrong livelihood, you can see that some of these things which are mentioned for the monastic community are not wrong in themselves or don't carry with them a negative karmic effect, such as dealing in poisons might, but it's not appropriate for those who are leading the holy life. But again, of course, we know that many people do practice these arts, and because of their position as a monk or a nun, as a holy person, they have much more given much more credibility that they can actually accurately read horoscopes or tell people's past or future. Yes, there's nothing wrong with herbalism. It's that it shouldn't be practiced by a monk or a nun towards lay people. It could be, usually because it also involves close physical contact, so especially for monks with lay women and nuns with lay men. It also often involves some form of remuneration for the service that's been given, that kind of thing. Making the herbal medicines requires a lot of time and energy and finding the right ingredients. So these are all distractions for someone whose purpose is the realization of enlightenment. And this is why the Buddha is mentioning this, remember, that he's saying that the holy life lived unwisely won't lead to the fruit. And if the aspiration is for enlightenment, then the aspiration has to be backed up by living the life in accordance with that aspiration. So practicing herbal medicine, there's nothing wrong with it. And if a monk or a nun has skills, they can treat people within the monastic community. or a lay person who's working or living in the monastery and who falls ill, but they shouldn't engage in medical practice with the lay community generally. The higher ordained monks and nuns can't remove vegetation, and they can't directly ask for the vegetation to be removed. So it does put a limit on what one can do as a monastic, and the idea is to strengthen that intention towards harmlessness. Because in cutting that or digging vegetation, there's a possibility that you will cause harm. Yes. So the next factor is wrong effort, and when we get getting into wrong effort and wrong mindfulness and wrong concentration, we are looking at the object of the effort or the mindfulness and the concentration, and also the way that that practice is used. What is the result of using that practice? So with right effort, the effort is to identify unwholesome objects and to not entertain them in the mind, and to identify wholesome objects and develop them and make them grow. So wrong effort could be to do the opposite, to indulge in unwholesome, unskillful objects, allowing them to invade the mind and take over the mind, and not perceiving that that is wrong effort or that there's danger in it. So a wrong object could be to think about how one can make more money from this disciple, or how one can take advantage, use one's position of authority to take advantage of a situation. So instead of entertaining skillful, wholesome thoughts, one entertains unskillful, unwholesome thoughts. And if you're not putting in an effort to even become familiar with the mind and to cultivate what is wholesome, because this is one of the aspects of right effort, if wholesome thoughts aren't arising in the mind, to actively cultivate them. So if one starts to put effort into cultivating unskillful thoughts, that is wrong effort. If one doesn't put any effort into cultivating wholesome thoughts, then that is also wrong effort. So it's going off the track right from the point of the way one thinks and uses one's mind, particularly in allowing unwholesome thoughts to take over the mind and not making the correct effort to identify them and then to remove them and to displace them with wholesome thoughts. And this is actually very important, because very often, well, we spend most of our life off the meditation cushion. We spend most of our life not in meditation, and we very often fail to take control of the mind in those non-meditating times of the day. We just allow it to run riot. We just allow it to go wherever it will, and to indulge in what it wants, because part of right effort is guarding the senses, indriya samvara. And this means making the effort not to expose the mind to the things which will disturb it, to the things which will arouse it, the things which will stimulate it, in unskillfulness. And we often don't make right effort, except when we get onto the meditation cushion, and then we start to try to work out what's good and what's bad in the mind, what's helpful and what's not helpful. And we find that we're overwhelmed because for the rest of the day we aren't making any kind of effort to guard the mind or to remove those thoughts which are unskillful. So this is very important when we're talking about producing the conditions for success in this life. It's not only about the aspiration that's the end goal, and not only about what we do when we're doing formal sitting practice, but how we lead the whole of our life. This is where we contribute to the conditions, the necessary conditions for the result. So with wrong mindfulness, again, it's two aspects. One is the object that we're paying attention to, and the other is the way that we pay attention to the object. So we may be mindful of an unskillful state, and we keep paying attention to it in a way of encouraging that state to continue. We may have anger in the mind, and we may know that we're angry, but we just keep that anger rolling along. We don't recognize the anger as a causally produced mental state that has arisen, and that we don't have to identify with it. We don't have to indulge in it by thinking about it and justifying it. We're trying to be mindful of it as a passing event, detaching from it, recognizing anger is present, but not indulging it, not validating it, not enjoying it. But if we have wrong mindfulness, when anger arises, we don't do any of that. We know that we're angry and we roll in the anger. We think about all the good reasons why we should be angry. We might even make our anger grow so that we can feed off the energy of anger. And so this isn't really right mindfulness, particularly because there's no sense that this is something that isn't me, mine, or a self, that it's a produced state, produced because of causes and conditions. So when we are looking at it with wrong mindfulness, we are identifying with it, and indulging in the storyline of it reinforces that sense of this is me, this is mine, this is justified. The other way in which we can indulge in wrong mindfulness is that we are not precise in our mindfulness. We are hazy in our mindfulness. We're in a sloppy state of mind, distracted state of mind, and our mindfulness really is not very sharp. So we have the object that we're looking at. We're looking at it with a strong sense of attachment, and we can also then be not looking at things sharply for wrong mindfulness. And it becomes more obvious when we think about wrong concentration. And one of the examples that's given for wrong concentration is that a bank robber who's trying to crack a safe is very mindful and is very concentrated. Mindfulness means paying attention, and concentration means paying attention moment after moment after moment until you're only aware of that one object. And so a bank robber who's trying to crack a safe is very mindful of what he's doing, of every turn, of every sound, of every click, every movement. Mindfulness with concentration, but the object is a wrong object. the intention is a wrong intention, the action is a wrong action, and so it is wrong concentration. The other sense in which it's wrong concentration is when one again assumes that the concentration that has developed, the state of mind that's developed, is me, is mine, is myself. And then we attach to that concentrated state and we again try to use it for our gain. So when the mind becomes very powerful through concentration, the mind is able to very often overwhelm adversaries, that is, other people who don't agree with you, to use the level of concentration that one develops, the strength of mind, to in many cases bully other people because of the level of concentration that one has reached. So this is another way in which wrong concentration arises. So the object and also the way that we use the mind for our own purposes, this is what brings about or is defined as wrong concentration. And if one makes an aspiration or not, if one leads the holy life, developing this path of wrong aspects, then one will not procure the fruit of the holy life. And now the Buddha goes on to outline some very interesting and illustrative similes for what he's been talking about. So before we read those, are there any questions about the wrong eightfold path? As for remembering all sorts of things, just remembering the first letters, so right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So just remembering the letters and making a word out of it, even if you have to turn that word around to make more sense, so that it makes something to you, to remember that it's in three parts. So that's also a useful way of remembering its sila, samadhi and panya. So Well, the other thing is, if you can think about what connects them, you know, they actually work together. So the sila part, the right speech, the right action, the right livelihood, you know, that's all the things we do out there in the world, you know, that what's seen outside, the right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration is what goes on in here, the actual doing part. And then the right view and the right intention is what flows from it. So if you sort of get a sense of you're dealing with the outer, the inner, and then... Okay. So these similes are very illustrative in themselves. Suppose a man needing oil, seeking oil, wandering in search of oil, were to heap up gravel in a tub, sprinkle it all over with water and press it. Then if he made an aspiration and acted thus, he would be unable to procure any oil. If he made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be unable to procure any oil. If he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be unable to procure any oil. If he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be unable to procure any oil. Why is that? Because that way of acting is not a proper method for procuring oil. So too, whatever recluses and Brahmins have wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness and wrong concentration, they are still unable to procure any fruit. Why is that? Because that wrong path is not a proper method for procuring fruit. Suppose a man needing milk, seeking milk, wandering in search of milk, were to pull a recently calved cow by her horn. Then if he made an aspiration, if he made no aspiration, if he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, and if he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be unable to procure any milk. Why is that? Because that way of acting is not a proper method for procuring milk. So whatever recluses and Brahmins have this wrong view, etc., they're still unable to procure any fruit. Why is that? Because that wrong path is not a proper method for procuring fruit. So in the first simile, the man needing oil heaps up gravel in a tub. And you can see from that one that he's got the wrong ingredients to start with. So that's why he could never get the result. But in the second simile, the ingredients are there, but the way that he's acting, the milk is there, but he's not knowing how to get the milk out. So he's not wisely using what's there. The first one, the right ingredients aren't there. The second one, the ingredients are there, but there's no skill in knowing how to procure them, procure the milk. Suppose a man needing butter, seeking butter, wandering in search of butter, were to pour water into a churn and churn it with a churning stick. Then if he made an aspiration, if he made no aspiration, if he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, if he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be unable to procure any butter. Why is that? Because that way of acting is not a proper method for procuring butter. So too, whatever recluses and Brahmins have wrong view, etc., they're still unable to procure any fruit. Why is that? Because of that wrong path is not a proper method for procuring fruit. And in this simile, this is a very good one to just imagine that you're willing to do the work, you're willing to churn, you're willing to put in all the effort. Effort alone is not enough. And this is again an important point, that the whole path has to be there, all the factors have to be there. Even if the effort is there, if it's without the right other ingredients, even if you're making the right effort, in this sense you're churning, using the churn in the right way, if you put water in there, you won't get butter. And this is often when we don't realise that it's not just a matter of putting in effort, it has to be the effort in the right way, and it has to be with the right ingredients, not just some of the ingredients. Effort itself won't get the result. Effort alone. Suppose a man needing fire, seeking fire, wandering in search of fire, were to take an upper fire stick and rub a wet, sappy piece of wood with it. Then if he made an aspiration, if he made no aspiration, if he made both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, if he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be unable to procure any fire. Why is that? Because that way of acting is not a proper method for procuring fire. So too, whatever recluses and Brahmins have wrong view, etc., they're still unable to procure any fruit. Why is that? Because that wrong path is not a proper method for procuring fruit. And again, it's always interesting to contemplate the images that the Buddha gives, because here we have an upper fire stick and a wet, sappy piece of wood. So you've got part of the ingredients that you need. And the sappy piece of wood, if left to dry out, would eventually produce the result that you want with the upper fire stick. But it's still not mature, if you like. It's still not the right equipment for the work that you've got to do. And this is what happens when we try to practice the spiritual path, that very often we've got some of the ingredients, but we haven't got all of them, or we've got some that are maturing and not others. We've only got part of the package. And we need to not only identify what we've got and what's missing, but also be patient and keep going until we have accumulated or developed all the necessary conditions for the path to arise. Whatever recluses and Brahmins have right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, if they make an aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are able to procure fruit. If they make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they are able to procure fruit. If they both make an aspiration and make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they're still able to procure fruit. If they neither make an aspiration nor make no aspiration and they lead the holy life, they're still able to procure fruit. Why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. Supposing a man needing oil, seeking oil, wandering in search of oil, were to heap up sesamum flour in a tub, sprinkle it all over with water and press it, then if he made an aspiration and acted thus, he would be able to procure oil. If he made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be able to procure oil. If he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be able to procure oil. If he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be able to procure oil. Why is that? Because that way of acting is a proper method for procuring oil. So too, whatever recluses and Brahmins have right view, etc., they're still able to procure fruit. Why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. Suppose a man needing milk, seeking milk, wandering in search of milk, were to pull a recently calved cow by her udder. Then if he made an aspiration, if he made no aspiration, if he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, if he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be able to procure milk. Why is that? Because that way of acting is a proper method for procuring milk. So too, whatever recluses and Brahmins have right view, etc., they're still able to procure fruit. Why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. And again, if we think about how this relates to our life and our lifestyle, it has something to do, we can just contemplate how many of us came into this path of practice without thinking, I want to become a Buddhist. But some of this makes sense, and so we start with just following the teaching as we've heard it and what makes sense and is useful for us, and we put that into practice, and we still don't necessarily have the sense of ourselves as being a Buddhist or wanting to be a Buddhist, but we just start to put the pieces together. And then little by little, according to the law of cause and effect, a deeper level of understanding opens up, and then the next part of the path opens up. So whatever starting point we have, whether we start with meditation or we like the idea of keeping precepts and having some guidelines for how to live in our daily life, as we develop those things, as we continue to work with them, then our understanding grows and it links us to another aspect of the path. And this is a natural progression, if you like. It's got nothing to do with calling ourselves Buddhist or even having the goal of enlightenment as our aspiration. If we continue to practice, then we just naturally move in that direction. So suppose a man needing butter, seeking butter, wandering in search of butter, were to pour curd into a churn and churn it with a churning stick. Then if he made an aspiration, if he made no aspiration, if he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, if he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be able to procure butter. Why is that? Because that way of acting is a proper method for procuring butter. So whatever recluses and Brahmins have right view, etc., they're still able to procure fruit. Why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. Suppose a man needing fire, seeking fire, wandering in search of fire, were to take an upper fire stick and rub a dry, sapless piece of wood with it. Then if he made an aspiration, if he made no aspiration, if he both made an aspiration and made no aspiration, if he neither made an aspiration nor made no aspiration and acted thus, he would still be able to procure fire. Why is that? Because that way of acting is a proper method for procuring fire. So too, whatever recluses and Brahmins have right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, they're still able to procure fruit. Why is that? Because that right path is a proper method for procuring fruit. So these four similes are very useful to bring into the mind and remember, because they are very clear similes that help us to see the connection between the ingredients and knowing what to do and getting the result. The ingredients, knowing what to do and doing it, keeping on doing it, leads to the result. And then the Buddha says, Bhumija, if these four similes had occurred to you with reference to Prince Jayasena, he would have spontaneously acquired confidence in you, and being confident would have shown his confidence to you. Venerable Sir, how could these four similes have occurred to me with reference to Prince Jayasena as they occur to the Blessed One, since they are spontaneous and have never been heard before? So Bhumija is saying to the Buddha, well, I couldn't come up with those sorts of things, and you've just come up with them on the spot, so how could I have come up with them? But anyway, that is what the Blessed One said, and the Venerable Bhumija was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's the end of the sutta, quite a straightforward sutta, but very important for us to realise that just having the aspiration, even if we know where we want to head, it's not enough. Even if we can do it in Pali, it's not enough. We have to actually put into practice what the requirements. And if we're doing what's not the path, then we can work very hard but still not receive the fruits of for our efforts, the fruits that we're seeking. And so whether it's worldly life or spiritual life, having our goals and setting our goals is important, but just wishing for them to happen, just hoping they'll fall out of the sky, won't work in material things, and it won't work in the spiritual life, whether we're a monastic or a lay person. So are there any questions arising out of that teaching? People can spend years going round in circles wondering why their practice isn't developing, and when they take a look, they see they're not actually putting in the work required. They're not putting in the necessary ingredients. Effort alone isn't enough. It has to be in the right direction for the right things.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So the question is it appropriate for a disciple to help monastics to keep their vows, for example, if in terms of the one about cutting down the trees, to if you see that that's something that needs to be done, to volunteer basically to do that work, and that's very helpful to look around and see what needs to be done and to do it. How does the law of karma play into the Noble Eightfold Path if one's putting in lots of effort and practicing the Noble Eightfold Path and one doesn't become enlightened in one's life, in this life, then it must be previous karma that's preventing that. And that's true. It depends what we're working with and also what we put into this life. If we understand that if we develop the path to the point of stream entry, for example, then bad karma that we have done in the past that would take us into an unfavourable rebirth at the end of this life, below the human realm, that can't fruit any longer if we have attained stream entry. Now, to attain stream entry, depending on our karmic inheritance, depending on what we've got to work with in this life, how much effort we put in, whether we're exposed to the teaching at an early age, all that sort of thing, whether the conditions are supportive for us, all that will interact with our past karma and then may produce a result in this life which is quite unexpectedly good, even if our past karma is not, all that bright. But because of what we're willing to put into cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path in this life, we may get the fruits, and that may lead us to be able to move ahead at quite an accelerated pace, only 7 more lifetimes if you're a stream winner. So it's very hard to say because of karma you can only do this much, because if you have a lot of suffering, for example, that might be a great incentive to practice really well. If you have very good karma and your life is easy, you may keep just, skimming the surface and not practicing diligently. And so you can't really say that the good karma is an advantage in cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path. If your good karma is such that it brings you into contact with the teaching and you have favourable conditions to practice in, like the teachers are available and you have, like we do here, a good group of practitioners coming together, all of those things, then that might be very helpful. But if you've got good karma that gives you a lot of material prosperity and a life of ease, it may distract you from any kind of spiritual pursuit. Does that say anything about your question? Yes. Well, no, actually, it's not in the human realm. It's seven more lifetimes. You can be reborn in the Deva realm as well. Yes. You can be born above, but you won't be born below a human birth. I think in the sutta it actually says seven. Seven more lifetimes. Ah, I'm not sure. I've always counted as seven more lifetimes. But come to rebirth for an eighth time, it says in the sutta. In the Ratana Sutta it says you won't come to an eighth existence. So that would indicate it's seven lifetimes plus this one. That's in the Ratana Sutta is where the Buddha mentions that seven more lifetimes, and it says you won't come to birth an eighth time. So, sorry? No, in the sutta it says you won't come to birth an eighth time, so I'm taking it as seven, including more on top of this one, seven more lifetimes. But I could be wrong. We'll see. Yes, it could be fewer. That's the most. It could be less. You could, if you become a stream winner, you might go all the way to enlightenment, and it's the end. It's not that you're bound to have seven more lifetimes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. This is one of the tricky questions that you don't like to get at the end of the class. It's about, is everything karma? The Buddha could see into the future and see who could get enlightened and who couldn't, and then the effort that you put in is karma. It's almost like it's preordained. There are choices within limits. That's the way I like to look at it. And within the limits of our karma, there are choices that we can make. So the Buddha says that this body, for example, is old action. It's a result of our old karma. We get this body. But with this body, we have choices how we use what we've got, the resources that we've got in this body, our strength and our intelligence and any kind of skills we've got. We're constantly making choices about how we use that. So we've got a set of conditions and we work with those conditions, and how we work with them is where we make new karma. Now, what tendencies we have towards making wholesome or unwholesome karma, that is going to be affected by other causes and conditions, and they all come together and interact and affect each other. To find a starting point, you know, that's what the Buddha said is impossible. And also to work it all, karma out exactly, and to answer these questions can drive you crazy. So I'm certainly not claiming to understand it all to the point where I can say to you, this is exactly how it is. But for my own approach, I like to think of it as working within a set of conditions, and that there is choice within those set of conditions. Well, no, because as you become more mindful, mindfulness that you put effort into, these things grow as a result of the new karma you're making. So the karma of putting in effort allows for mindfulness to grow. And then when mindfulness grows and you start to see the results of your actions more clearly, you start to be aware of a conditioned habit pattern as you're in the middle of it, as it's just starting to arise, and you can use your greater mindfulness to put a stop to that before it gets out of control. All of those things are new karma that you've made now. And so as you make a step, for example, to put in the effort and to develop mindfulness, that opens up a whole new range of conditions, but within a set of limitations. But what it produces is even more. So, for example, it's a very coarse kind of analogy, but for example, if you plant a seed and produces a lovely flower, then the effect of producing that flower is going to be that birds and insects can come and feed on it, that people will see it and be delighted by it. Someone might take that flower and with great devotion offer it at the shrine. The flow-on effect of all the karmic consequences of you just doing that one thing is sort of unknowable at the time you do it, and what it will produce in you, because you might see all of those things happening and just, you know, rejoice in it. And that rejoicing may open your eyes to something that you've never seen before, and that wisdom may then encourage you to do something that you've never would never have taken on as a habit pattern. So you now start planting flowers because not just for the flower, but although you see the... So when we're talking about karma and these are conditions, we tend to think in linear, you know, I did this and I'll get that and this is the result. But it's multiple. And it's not only what it means for us, it's what it means for others, and then how we interact with that. You know, the sight of someone benefiting from our action. It's complicated, yes. Well, I think that's the end of the class.